Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks when she saw what she had done, gave her father 41.
Exactly. Like that. Right. Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 7. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is a Nine Muses Books production. This is the only podcast devoted to Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders of 1892. Episode 7, A Lizzie Borden Primer, Part 3. Today on the Lizzie Borden Podcast, we return to the Lizzie Borden Primer. This is our third installment of the Primer, and the fourth time that we've been talking with Sarah Miller, author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century, available from Random House Children's Books. Over the past few installments, we've covered Fall River history, Lizzie Borden's childhood and life before the murders, the events leading up to the crime, and the tragedy that struck on August 4, 1892, when Andrew Borden and his wife Abby were murdered at their home at 92 Second Street in Fall River, Massachusetts. We followed the police investigation and how it led right to Lizzie Borden. We left off last time after her disastrous performance at the inquest and how Lizzie was finally arrested. Today we're going to discuss the trials, and by trials I mean the preliminary hearing, the grand jury investigation, and the trial before the Superior Court, where Lizzie Borden and her defense team fought a brutal battle during the month of June 1893. Before we continue with the primer, I just want to make an announcement that the Lizzie Borden Podcast is currently producing a radio drama based on The Agitated Elocutionist, a Lizzie Borden girl detective mystery. This is an exciting project with a group of extremely talented actors and will be available exclusively on this podcast sometime after the new year. Other future episodes of this podcast will include a fourth primer installment that will cover Lizzie Borden's years after her acquittal, her years in Maplecroft, which include the Nance O'Neill controversy, the Tilden Thurber incident, Emma Borden's abandonment of her sister in 1905, and Lizzie's reclusive and declining years. We're also going to have some more Fall River history, including the Great Fires, the subject of a new book by Dr. Stephanie Corey, as well as other historic Fall River crimes. Also in the works is an episode about the death of Rebecca Cornell, an unsolved crime from colonial Rhode Island. Lizzie Borden fans will appreciate this strange tale of murder and mystery from the earliest days of New England history. So we have lots of exciting episodes of the Lizzie Borden Podcast planned for the next few months. But for now, we're going to pick up our story after Lizzie Borden was arrested for the murder of her father and stepmother. We're talking with Sarah Miller, who has been gracious enough to come back for the fourth time to our podcast. Welcome back to the podcast, Sarah.
Hi, glad to be here again.
Lizzie Borden's family had an attorney, Andrew Jennings.
Yep. I think he was called one of the ablest corporation lawyers in the area at the time.
Had he done business with Andrew Borden before this? Or
I think so. And he had known Andrew Borden when Mr. Jennings was a child. He had known Andrew Borden. And he said that at the preliminary hearing when he was doing maybe his opening remarks. He said, if I exhibit more emotion than you think is customary or appropriate, basically, this is the reason. It's because I've known these people since I was small myself. I never imagined that I would be serving in this capacity.
Yeah, Jennings comes across as relatively sincere and straightforward. Even people who think that Lizzie Borden was guilty, you know, they tend to have a prejudice against Knowlton because they see him as the bad guy, which is kind of odd because they believe Lizzie Borden is guilty.
Well, I think that shows just how adept Jennings was at his job, because although he wasn't over the top, he used emotion to further his point, and that cast Knowlton as this sort of cool kind of character, and he was left with just logic and reason, and by comparison, that makes him seem less sympathetic, where Jennings, because of his actual personal connection with the Bordens, was just taken an entirely different tactic.
At the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast today, there are two rooms in the attic that are right next to each other. They're adjacent. One of them is the Knowlton room, and the other is the Jennings room. So I always think amusedly of that, of these two rooms dedicated to the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney in the house. And of course, there's always joking around people who stay there that they're on different sides of the... To stay in one room, you have to believe in her guilt, and the other, you have to believe in her innocence. There's also an anomaly in the Knowlton room where there's kind of a red rust stain coming down one of the pillars. It's one of those attic rooms where there's a slanting roof, and then there's a pillar in the middle, and there's a red rust stain coming down. So
I never noticed that when I was there. That's funny.
When they do their paranormal ghost tour, they say that it's like blood that appears, and it gets gets redder on Halloween night. The next incident of note is the preliminary hearing. And could you give a quick explanation of what the preliminary hearing is and how it would differ from a trial?
Preliminary hearings, the quickest way to describe that is sort of a dress rehearsal for the trial, but it's one-sided. It's all up to the prosecution to present enough evidence to the judge, and only the judge, that this person is probably guilty and therefore it warrants a trial. You know, we should go further this because of this evidence which points toward guilt. So the prosecution just has to convince one person, the judge.
And the preliminary hearing in and of itself is an extraordinary document because we have all the cast of characters, including the members of the family, including the neighbors like Alice Russell and Mrs. Churchill, including Bridget the maid, including the police officers, including Marshall Hilliard. Yeah, we have all these people giving their testimony X number of months after the crime, months before the actual trial itself. And one could make a lifelong study out of the differences between these.
Yeah, there are.
Like how people's memory improved or deteriorated over time, about whether you could assess whether they're telling the truth or not. Unfortunately, half of the inquest is actually missing. We don't have it. But we do have enough, you know, for us to have Uncle John and I believe Uncle John and Bridget's testimony from the inquest, which is very, very important.
Well, in the preliminary hearing, I mean, that testimony was lost for years and years. It wasn't until they found it in Jennings' attic in, like, what, the 1960s?
Yeah.
We had the inquest, we had the trial, and we had nothing in between for many decades.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? Because
yeah.
I read the preliminary hearing right now, and I just can't believe that we could ever not have that.
Well, it's basically the rough draft of the trial because, I mean, Jennings does not have the opportunity to present evidence in Lizzie's favor. That's just not how a preliminary hearing works. But he does have the opportunity to cross-examine. So you get to see Knowlton sort of trying out his best points of evidence and Jennings trying to undermine those points of evidence.
After the preliminary hearing, the next big legal proceeding was the grand jury. And could you explain what the purpose of the grand jury was?
The grand jury, I mean, and this is the point when it starts to feel like, haven't we done all this already? Yes, we have. But the grand jurors are sort of the last step, the last chance to, from the defense's point of view, to avoid the trial. We've already convinced the judge that there's enough evidence to suggest strongly that this person is guilty. Now we're going to put it to this large jury to decide, should we invest now in a formal trial? And it's usually, I want to say, 13 to 21 jurors, depending on where you are. It's larger than a trial jury, which is customarily 12 people. And it functions, I think, again, much like the preliminary hearing, but you have a much broader panel of people that you're trying to sway in your direction if you're the prosecution and you want to go to trial, you have to get it past this large jury. That's what the grand jury, it's grand in the sense, just means large.
And if the grand jury promotes it to trial, that means it will now go to the Superior Court in New Bedford.
Yeah, we're going to indict her. That's the grand jury's job, is
right.
To say, do we indict or do we not indict?
And something very dramatic comes out of the grand jury. There's a reconvening after they've done their proceedings. They reconvene to take the testimony of Alice Russell. Now, Alice Russell is a woman who has played a large role in the story so far. She's the woman who Lizzie visited the night before the murders with her extraordinary tale of someone trying to harm her family. Alice Russell was one of the first people on the crime scene on the morning of August 4th. And Alice Russell stayed with Lizzie Borden in the house for several days after the murders. Now Alice Russell comes forward with quite an extraordinary tale that people didn't quite expect.
Alice Russell was apparently tormented by her conscience after she had given testimony at the grand jury because there was something she knew that nobody else knew, so nobody knew to ask her about it. And your job when you're sitting in the witness box is not to volunteer information, but to ask questions. And she was troubled by that aspect where she had more information than anybody knew to try and pull out of her. So she consulted a lawyer and said, is there any way around this? She didn't want to tell on Lizzie, but she felt that because of her oath, she would have been, you know, legally evading what she'd promised to do by telling the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. She hadn't told the whole truth. And that crucial piece of information that was keeping her up at night was that she had seen Lizzie Borden burn a blue dress on Sunday morning. Would that have been the 7th of August?
Yes, you're right. Sunday morning, August 7th.
Sunday morning, August 7th, Alice comes downstairs to breakfast, or was it just after breakfast? Doesn't even matter. She comes downstairs. Emma is washing dishes with her back to the room, to the kitchen. Lizzie is standing in the corner by the stove where there's a cupboard, and she is pulling some fabric out of that cupboard. And Alice hears Emma say something like, what are you going to do? And Lizzie says, I'm going to burn this thing up. It's all covered with paint. And Alice sees this. And this is at a point when they're still under house arrest. There's still policemen ringing the property. I want to say about four officers are in the immediate vicinity. The shutters are open, the windows open. It's August. It's in the morning. It's hot, you know. So on one hand, Lizzie is not being sneaky about this at all because she's in plain sight for anybody who cares to bother to look through the window. But Alice says, I wouldn't let anybody see me do that if I were you, Lizzie. Lizzie takes one step backward, which is kind of cute because it's not like she gained any, you know, cover by doing that. Alice was uncomfortable. She left the room. And as far as we know, Lizzie fed that dress to the flames. This is after the police had searched. After she had turned over the dress voluntarily, they said, we want the dress that you were wearing that morning. So she gave them a dress Saturday. Sunday morning, there she is in the kitchen preparing to put another dress into the stove,
claiming that it's stained with paint.
Stained with paint. She held up the hem so that Alice could see it. Alice saw that it was indeed soiled. Alice saw no blood, but Alice was very uncomfortable, and she wanted to tell the grand jury what she knew, and so she did. And the timeline, although we have no testimony, the timeline suggests very strongly that that was the tipping point for the grand jury to choose to indict Lizzie Borden.
So considering the lack of real strong physical evidence tying Lizzie Borden to these crimes, the grand jury may have been on the verge of letting her go.
It's entirely possible because there was a gap of about a week before the last known chunk of testimony. We were hearing more than one case in this 2 or 3 week span where in which a grand jury was convened. And I want to say there's about a week where we know they were hearing Borden testimony. Then there's a gap. Then Alice Russell comes forward, and she was not the only person who was recalled. I think Adelaide Churchill was also gave more testimony, but we have no idea what facts were relayed by the other people. The only thing we know for sure is that Alice Russell, right near the very beginning of December, informed the grand jury of this dress burning incident. And within a day or two, Lizzie is indicted for the murder of Andrew and Abby Borden.
Right. So now she has to sit in jail yet again, waiting for a trial, that could end in her being sent to the gallows or her being convicted to an insane asylum. Well, at this point, the Lizzie Borden case, otherwise known as the Borden murders, I do not like to call them the Lizzie Borden murders because, one, Lizzie Borden was not murdered. Second of all, she may not have been the person who committed the murders.
Right.
So you either call it the Lizzie Borden affair, the Lizzie Borden case, or the Borden murders, which is what I prefer to call it. And I'm glad that's what you chose for your book title. At this point, the case is extremely sensational. It's actually being nationally reported upon. During the trial itself, I think there was international reporting on the case.
Yeah, big journalists were coming into town. I mean, there was a man who was very well known at the time. He'd covered the trial following the Lincoln assassination. It was big news.
Yeah, I even heard that people in Tokyo were following the case. This is Tokyo in 1893, and the newspapers are filled with this murder case from New England. A lot of stuff that went on while Lizzie was sitting there waiting for her trial. There was actually another hatchet murder in Fall River and that resembled the Borden murders. A woman named Bertha Manchester was killed. I plan to do an entire podcast on the Bertha Manchester case. It's fascinating. But this happened while Lizzie Borden was sitting in her cell. A lot of people took it to mean that the killer was still at large and Lizzie Borden was innocent. But the facts of the case turned out to go against that assumption. There was also something known as the Tricky McHenry affair. Could you briefly describe what happened there?
Yes. A newspaper reporter believed that he had obtained just the most marvelous scoop in the Borden case. He paid $500 to a man who was a fraud on many different levels. And the Boston Globe printed it without fact-checking anything. And it was just the greatest load of hooey in a single article. I mean, there's hooey all throughout the Borden case, but this one was just the humdinger.
I believe they even made up a fictional list of witnesses that were going to go
to
trial.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have taken so little for the newspaper to even fact check to the point where they say these people don't even exist.
It was basically the equivalent of open the phone book and see if George Sisson of this address exists, because the man doesn't exist. But they didn't. They were so afraid that somebody would beat them to the story that they printed it. And it's so salacious and so satisfying that it should have been clear to anybody with a lick of sense that this was baloney.
Because not only the fictional names, but the content of the testimony was revealed. And the content turned out to be all made up, including sexual abuse within the family and
incest and all kinds of just ridiculous stuff.
It didn't take too long for the fictional nature of this to come to light.
No, it was like 24 hours or something, and the Globe is going, oh, we've blown it. They issued a formal apology boxed like on the front page to Lizzie Borden and Uncle Morse as well.
Yeah, now as usual, even though when the newspapers retract something like this, there is a portion of the population that still believes it. It starts spiraling off and creating its own myths and urban legends.
Right, but the plus side for Lizzie was that then she had gained that newspaper's sympathy, and that was one of the most prominent papers in Boston at the time. And the Globe coverage, from my perspective, was very good. When I got into the Globe archives online, I just died happily for several hours just reading the stuff because it was good.
Is any of that in the David Kent book, the scrapbook?
I think there is. Yeah, the Joe Howard columns are in the David Kent scrapbooks. And so there would be the Howard columns, and then there would be like another just straight up non-opinion news story as well. So those might not be in there, but the Howard stuff is.
Well, Sarah, we have to take a break now. You've been listening to the Lizzie Borden podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens. And we've been talking with guest Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. We're going to take a break and listen to this word from Nine Muses Books.
Nine Muses Books is proud to sponsor the Lizzie Borden podcast. Nine Muses Books is an independent press featuring the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series written by author Richard Behrens. These well-crafted comic mysteries set a fictionalized Lizzie as a teenage detective against a real Victorian-era Fall River, Massachusetts. The characters are remarkably vivid. The narrative is intellectually stimulating, and as one critic has described it, author Richard Behrens really knows how to toss delightfully deceptive literary curveballs that keep the reader mystified until just that penultimate perfect moment. Michael Martins of the Fall River Historical Society has called these stories a must-read for all those intrigued by Fall River history, mystery, and of course, Lizzie Borden. Shelley Dizek of the Lizzie Borden Warps and Wefts blog has written that the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective series are so much fun, it's nearly criminal. The Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mysteries can be found on Amazon in ebook format, and most books are offered as free downloads. In addition to these short stories, there is also the full-length novel The Minuscule Monk, offered in both print book and ebook formats. For more information, go to LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com and sign up for our newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and listen to our podcasts on iTunes. Visit the Garden Bay Films channel on YouTube to see special visual editions of our podcasts, as well as the Lizzie mini-series. And now, back to the Lizzie Borden podcast.
We're back to the Lizzie Borden podcast, and you're listening to the Lizzie Borden Primer, Part 3, with guest Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. So Lizzie Borden goes to trial on June 5th, 1893, and the trial lasts until June 20th. June 20th was the day of the reading of the verdict. Now, the trial is very complicated, very long, full of complicated timelines, complicated testimony. Testimony of neighbors who saw suspicious doings in the neighborhood at the time of the murders. There's testimony by the people who were in the house. Testimony by the people who were friends of the family, like Alice Russell and Mrs. Churchill, who were there that day. Testimony from the city officials and the policemen. So a lot of this could be broken down into testimony about the crime investigation, testimony about the family, testimony, you know, especially from the defense coming up with witnesses who may have evidence that somebody else did it. So this is thousands of pages. And it's a hardy soul who can go in and navigate through all of that. But I've distilled out of it a few salient points that would be worth mentioning here. And these are all related to how Lizzie Borden possibly got away with it, how she got acquitted. And there was evidence that was damning to her, like the dress, the burning of the dress. But nobody could really be consistent about their observations of what dress Lizzie Borden had on that morning as opposed to what she had on in the afternoon.
Right. For some reason, I don't know why that pink striped wrapper, maybe because it was pink and striped, I don't know. Everybody was able to describe that dress quite clearly, including one police officer who described it like a dressmaker and made everybody laugh. But that blue dress that she was wearing when she discovered and or committed the crime, when you read the individual's descriptions, you cannot piece them together to form a coherent garment. It's just not possible. Adelaide Churchill's, I think, is the most clear description. But then Adelaide Churchill, if I'm remembering right, is the only person who claims that the dress that Lizzie provided to them, to the prosecution, and it's displayed in court. I think she may be the only one who says, yeah, that's the dress she was wearing. So it's just a mess. One of the police officers was colorblind. So asking him to describe this thing is like, oh, cripe. At the preliminary hearing, that officer, Daugherty or Harrington, he's asked, will you pick out something, a garment, something in the audience that matches the shade of blue of that dress that you're trying to describe, and he points out a man's white necktie.
So he was not even aware that he was colorblind, or the
I don't know. It certainly seems that way.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, one witness says like it has a diamond pattern. One witness says it's white sprigged pattern. It's impossible to construct a garment that fits all of those descriptions.
So Alice Russell's testimony about the burning of the dress is actually good for the prosecution. But when the prosecution tried to really nail down and prove through witness testimony that Lizzie Borden had on one dress at the time of the murder and then changed to another, everything kind of tumbled into confusion. To the point where I can imagine the jury saying, look, nobody really knows what was going on.
Yeah. You could almost argue that they overdid it, because by having, you know, so many witnesses trying to describe that dress, it made it impossible to envision such a garment.
And I believe Emma Borden, her sister, did come forward at least to her defense and said, yeah, we painted the house and the dress got paint on it. And I said to Lizzie, you should burn that dress. Or burning a dress was actually an acceptable way of getting rid of clothing back then.
A normal thing. Alice Russell even said that she had seen that dress, that Bedford cord, precisely two times. Once when it was made and had been, you know, and was soiled, and then on the incidents of its burning.
Yeah.
And that seems to rule out her having seen it the morning of the murders.
And Alice Russell was the first one on the scene that morning. So if Lizzie did not have time to change her dress, then it's quite possible that Alice Russell saw her in the dress that she had on the morning of the murders.
Alice Russell could have seen it, Bridget, Mrs. Churchill, and Dr. Bowen, but none of their descriptions match.
It's not too much to assume that if she had seen the dress, she would have recognized it.
Mm-hmm. Although the complicating factor here is that Lizzie Borden owned 8 or 10 blue dresses.
Yes,
it appears
that's true.
That she was very fond of the color blue, and between Lizzie and Emma, there were 10 blue dresses, I want to say, in that house. But the majority of Lizzie's wardrobe is blue.
If you go to the house today and you walk up the front stairs, you're confronted with three doorways. To your right is Lizzie Borden's bedroom. Straight ahead is the guest room where the murder occurred, and to the left is a bathroom for guests.
Yep.
You know, if you rent the rooms out for the night, you use that bathroom. Well, that bathroom used to be their dressing room, Emma and Lizzie's dressing room. And one can only imagine the number of dresses that were in there.
Yeah, it's fairly large. I mean, it would qualify as a walk-in closet nowadays. The other thing is that even though State Detective Seaver and the Fall River Assistant Marshal Fleet searched that closet Saturday, 6th of August, under questioning at the trial, it becomes clear they were so fixated on looking for blood that they retained almost no information about the fabrics, the dresses that they were handling. George Seaver could not say, did you handle an alpaca, a challis, a calico, or whatever? And he was also further forced to admit that he couldn't tell the difference between those types of fabric anyway. He was ignorant of the types of fabric. Oh, he didn't remember having seen a pink dress when everybody literally around the world knew that Lizzie Borden owned a pink striped dress. George Seaver said, no, I couldn't tell you if there was a pink dress in there. He mentioned a black silk, at which point, according to the newspapers, Lizzie leans over to her defense attorney and says, I don't have a black silk. It could have been Mrs. Borden's black silk, but not Lizzie's.
What happened with the police investigation and the crime scene was tragic because the scene was highly compromised and there was a lot of incompetence. Unfortunately, the Alice Russell's dress burning testimony was not enough to send Lizzie to the, the gas chamber. I've been reading too much Sherlock Holmes lately. Unfortunately, or fortunately for Lizzie, Alice Russell's dress burning testimony was kind of undermined by the trial. So the prosecution, they had a couple of aces up their sleeve. That was one ace that was knocked out of their hand. Another ace that was knocked out of their hand was the dismissal of her inquest testimony. Knowlton himself who was the prosecuting attorney at the trial, he personally had conducted Lizzie Borden's interrogation during the inquest. And he really came on hard. And as we mentioned before, her testimony kind of broke down. You know, she became very inconsistent. She became very scattered and fragmented and may have been influenced by the morphine that she was having. But in the end, they had some pretty damning testimony. And that was not allowed to be read into the record of the trial because of technicalities, one of which was that at the time that she gave that testimony back at the inquest, she had already been informed that she was a suspect in the trial.
And the marshal had a warrant for her arrest in his pocket, which is referred to as the pocket warrant.
Right. So the protocol had been broken.
Yeah. Because at any point, if she said something that they felt was like, ooh, that shows that she did it, they could have, on the spot, whipped that warrant out and arrested her, which that's not really how the legal system's supposed to work.
So that's the second ace that was knocked out of Knowlton's hand. And another ace that he lost was the dismissal of Eli Bence's testimony. Eli Bence, as you may remember, was the pharmacist from down on South Main Street who claimed that the day before the murders, Lizzie Borden came into the pharmacy he was working at as a clerk and asked to buy, 10 cents worth of prussic acid?
10 cents worth of prussic acid, yeah.
Which could have been a murder weapon. Could have been Lizzie Borden trying to buy a murder weapon. His testimony was knocked out of court. It was not allowed to be admitted. The reason being, if I remember, the three judges, there were actually three judges on the bench during this trial. Chief Justice Albert Mason, Associate Justice Kaylee Blodgett, and Associate Justice Justin Dewey. They were the presiding judges. They ruled that the events at the pharmacy were too remote in time from the time of Andrew and Abby Borden's murder to have any relevance to the case.
Well, and as the lead defense attorney also said, she is charged with having murdered these people with a hatchet or some other sharp implement. Poisoning, in his opinion, was irrelevant because it was not how the Bordens had died. They had evidence from Harvard to prove that. There was no indication of irritation or poison in the stomach. And another thing he said was, you know, it's not a crime to buy this stuff. You might want it to kill the cat. That's not a crime. It's not nice for the cat, but, if you wanted to euthanize a pet, that was something that you could use.
It's very counterintuitive to our modern sensibilities to hear this, because we think, you know, the family, Lizzie Borden herself and Abby Borden both accuse somebody of poisoning them.
Yep.
and then Lizzie Borden appears trying to buy a poison. It goes against our common sense that this should be thrown out of court. But they did have their legal reasons, and they, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge. I don't know what the, whether this was outrageous or whether this was common sense legal proceeding.
And I think that even at the time, opinion was divided. They even, the prosecution brought in furriers to testify because, according to Bent, the woman's reason for wanting this poison was to put it on the edges of a sealskin cape to prevent vermin, moths, and rodents from nibbling the fur. So they tried to bring in people who dealt with fur to say, is this a valid use? I mean, is this something you would do? And even that, I think that's about the point when the three justices just cut it off and said, you're done. We're not going here.
So you have Knowlton standing there, you know, the mustache-twirling villain saying, yeah, wait, they got a load of this. And one by one, the aces up his sleeve are being knocked out. And he has one more. And, well, actually, I have two more listed here, but one more is the handleless hatchet. While a police officer who was one of the ones who found the handleless hatchet is on the stand, he casually makes reference to the handle that was found in the same box.
Yeah, and it almost goes right over people, because I think it's even while the defense is questioning him that it comes up.
Yes.
And Robinson almost lets it fly by, but the officer says, no, the handle. And it's like the whole courtroom stopped in shock. It's fun to read, because the guy, Robinson, who's this very adept lawyer, was hired for, I think the rumor is $25,000, just starts to babble. He's like, what? Asking these short, little, rapid-fire, are you kidding me kind of questions. And the guy just holds his ground and says, yeah, I saw that handle. And Assistant Marshal Fleet, he saw the handle too. He pulled it out of the box.
Yeah, this is like a bombshell that drops in court.
Yeah, Robinson turns to the prosecution and says, have you that handle? And Knowlton just sort of stammers, this is the first I've heard of it.
Yes. So they send some officers back to 92 Second Street to look for the handle, and they're not allowed into the house.
Emma won't let them in.
Yeah. Now, it's possible that if they found the handle, it would have made it easier to acquit Lizzie.
Yeah.
Because it would have shown that there was no subterfuge in the snapping of the
handle. It was clearly her right to refuse search. She may have just had enough because they've been so accommodating up to that point.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to say whether Emma letting them in or not letting them in is what led to people doubting that this handle hatchet, this handleless hatchet head was actually the murder weapon. Because if there was confusion among the police about the nature of the instrument itself, how could anyone trust it now?
Well, and that's the point at which the newspapers start calling it the hoodoo hatchet.
Yeah.
Because then the second thing that happens is they decide, all right, we're going to call the two officers who first found it. And they call those two men. And their accounts of having, you know, I said earlier, they found this thing and they thought it looked suspicious. So they wrapped it up in paper and sent it to the marshal. And I was deliberately kind of vague about that because one officer is going to tell you that he wrapped it up in brown paper, and it was a package. One of the newspapers said, and he demonstrated this on the stand, and he wrapped it up, and it was big enough, one of the papers said, to conceal a pair of longshoreman's shoes, where the other officer says, no, we wrapped it up in a piece of newspaper from the privy, and he wraps up this neat little thing that's about the size of a slice of pie. And they do this, not obviously not having seen the other man's demonstration, so they've just contradicting themselves right in front of the entire, you know, the jury, the whole audience is basically laughing into their sleeves at this performance because both of them are so in earnest. They're being so careful to do it just the way they remember doing it. And the disparity between those two packets is just astonishing.
Oh, yeah. So we have the prosecution now that was so arrogant about itself that they could send this woman to the gallows. They lose their bloody dress. Well, when I say lose, I mean they've undermined the credibility of their evidence.
Information. Yeah.
Yeah, they've lost the bloody dress. They've lost the prussic acid. They've lost the murder weapon. And there's an incident that happens in jail that we refer to as the Hannah Regan incident. Can you say something about that? It's a very interesting, it casts a little bit of ambiguous light upon the entire case.
There was a story that broke, I believe, during the preliminary hearing in the newspapers, in which it was claimed that the police matron, Hannah Reagan, had overheard a conversation between Lizzie and her sister Emma, in which Lizzie said, you've given me away.
Lizzie accusing Emma of...
Having given her away somehow by having told too much to Lawyer Jennings. And Emma replies, no, I only told him what he needed to know to defend you. And apparently Lizzie then says something, well, I won't give one inch. And she allegedly held up her little finger, like showing how little she would give, and then turned her back on her sister. And Lizzie, apparently, according to the story, sat there facing the wall for the next hour and a half, however long Emma was used to visiting. Emma, like, sat there for the duration of the customary visit and then left.
Now, this was allegedly overheard by Hannah Reagan, the matron.
Yes.
So what happened when Hannah Reagan testified at the trial about this?
Well, at the preliminary hearing, when it kind of broke, they were trying to thwart the story. There was this incident where Lizzie's side, the defense, was attempting to get Hannah Reagan to sign an affidavit to say this never happened, because she had been denying it. Hannah Reagan, once it hit the paper, said, no, this never happened. This reporter is, full of baloney. Wasn't me. They wanted to get her to sign something to that effect. And they claimed she was willing until it went to the marshal's office. And the marshal said, if you have anything to say, you'll say it on the stand. And then the issue was dropped until the trial. So here we have Hannah Reagan, who has possibly informed a reporter of this story, then tried to deny it, but is thwarted. Now she's on the stand. And she's kind of in an impossible position, because given her position of employment, if it comes out that she has leaked information to a reporter and or lied to a reporter, she's going to lose her job. If, on the other hand, it comes out that she's committing perjury by denying what she's already denied or denying what she said in the first place, I mean, there's no way for her to win. Jennings just goes to town with her and makes it infinitely clear that this is a mess and it's not of consequence and it can't be trusted. She tries to claim, how did it go? Because there was that thing with the egg.
Oh, that's right. They were laughing over the egg.
She tries to claim on the stand. She tries to stick with the original newspaper story that I was reporting the truth. This really did happen. And he starts to pick it apart. And he says, well, do you remember what happened after that? Because he was the person, he was the next visitor who, according to her story, sort of broke the ice and the incident then, like the day moved forward once he came in and Emma went home. So she's presenting him as somebody who brought to a close this argument. And he says to her, do you remember who else visited that day? And she starts to falter. Yeah, she says, well, Reverend Buck. And he says, are you sure? And she says, well, he always came. And that's when it starts to fall apart. And she realizes it and says, well, I was so upset by the argument between the two sisters that I can't remember anything more that happened that day. I was so flustered. And he doesn't take that answer either.
Yeah, there's a very strange moment where there's a self-referential circularity there, where Jennings mm-hmm. is trying to get her to talk about, to testify about a conversation she had with him. And it's very strange. You could see the frustration in Jennings trying to get this all... like suppressed.
And he brings her back around. He kind of sneaks around through the back door and he says, do you remember that day when you were all, there was Emma and Lizzie and another visitor and you were having a good time? There was something about an egg. And what it was that the matron had made a bet with Lizzie that Lizzie couldn't break an egg in the way that Hannah Reagan would describe to her. And Lizzie said, I can break an egg. Anybody can break an egg. So they make this bet for a quarter. And the challenge was to hold the egg in the palm of your hand and squeeze. Somebody ran out and got an egg, and Lizzie tried it and was amazed. It's one of those great lines where she says, "That's the first thing I have tried to do and couldn't."
when you're
the first
trial,
thing I tried to do but never could. I can't remember how she put it, but it's just fantastic.
When you're in trial for multiple murder, that might not be a very delicate thing to say.
Yeah, and so they all, they all laugh and have a good time about that, and her friends just think it's hilarious. And so Jennings brings this up to Hannah Reagan and says, weren't you all having a good time? She says, oh, yeah, we were having a great time that afternoon with the egg. And it dawns on her, it's the same day. She's just told him she was so upset she couldn't remember anything about the rest of the day. And then she says, we were having a super time laughing over the egg that afternoon. And here, this person were here. So her testimony, she's undermined herself. She has no credibility left. But it appears as though she did manage to keep her job, which is interesting.
So all the cards that Knowlton had up his sleeve have just vanished.
Yeah.
And it's very bad for the prosecution. He lost the murder weapon. He lost Lizzie's own testimony. He lost the dress. He lost Hannah Reagan.
He lost the poison.
That's right. Well, Hannah Reagan was a witness for the prosecution.
Yeah, but she might as well have testified to the defense.
None of that worked out well for the prosecution.
No.
So we come to June 20th, the day of the verdict. I don't know whether it was predictable or not. It certainly shocked a lot of people. It certainly angered a lot of people.
Well, so many people had come to court just to hear the closing arguments because these two sort of pillars of the legal establishment in that area were going head to head. And there were lawyers who took the day off just to come and listen to that because they just wanted to witness it. And it was a big deal. And Knowlton did very well with his closing argument, I think, where ex-Governor Robinson, who was actually first chair for the defense, he fell short, even though he was widely recognized as having been the better speaker overall. It was one of his talents, but he fell short that day.
So Lizzie Borden is acquitted.
Yes.
That's the verdict that comes back from the jury. Very shocking.
Yeah, and the courtroom just sort of erupts in primarily cheers. But yeah, there was division right away.
Lizzie did have a lot of support during her trial. A lot of people wrote her letters, visited her, supported the family. Her acquittal was good for her, obviously, but it lacked a sense of closure. Because if she was innocent, then what had actually happened that day?
Yeah, then who? And the police never targeted anyone else. I mean, the investigation just stopped.
Lizzie and Emma did put up their own money. They said that they would give a cash fee to anyone who had information that would lead to the killers. As far as I know, nothing ever came of that.
And Lizzie is recorded as having said, I would give every cent I own and beg in the streets if it could only be proved while I still live that I did not kill my father and my stepmother. But
we're going to take a break here, and we're going to wrap up this episode and come back next time where we're going to tackle the, 34 years that Lizzie Borden had left after the trial, her life in Fall River, her life in her house, Maplecroft. There was ambiguity up until her dying day. There's ambiguity up until this day, what actually happened on August 4th, 1892. So thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
It was great going over this with you. I look forward to seeing you next time on the Lizzie Borden podcast.
I look forward to it, too.
Thanks for listening to the Lizzie Borden podcast. We have the radio drama The Agitated Elocutionist, a Lizzie Borden girl detective mystery, coming up in February. And we'll be back with the Lizzie Borden Primer Part 4, The Maplecroft Years, very soon. We'll see you next time. This podcast was produced by Nine Muses Books and engineered by Mason Amadeus. The theme music was composed and performed by Melora Krieger. The Lizzie Borden podcast is sponsored by Nine Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. More information can be found at lizziebordenpodcast.com and lizziebordengirldetective.com.